Chapter 10. Edith, her head aching with the follies and perils of prolonged reminiscence, had finally made her way to bed at an advanced hour, when the entire hotel was silent and no cars could be heard on the road that ran the shore of the lake. Sleep had come suddenly like an anaesthetic, total blackness. When she opened her eyes, it was to the same unvariegated grey that had greeted her on the afternoon of her arrival. She had forgotten to pull the curtains and the daylight was all around her. Alarmed, if she had been absent from the scene for a long time, during which unknown events might have taken place, she sat up and reached for her watch. It was 8 o'clock, a reasonable hour at which to wake if one's day had no structure, but for Edith, who was accustomed to beginning her writing very early, sometimes even before the milk or newspaper had been delivered, guiltily and unconsciously late. She rang for her breakfast and bathed and dressed hastily, anxious to remove the traces of disarray into which previous night's thoughts had plunged. Then she went to the window and stepped out onto the little balcony. The unexpected cold made her shiver. One could hardly say that it was winter, but it seemed as though it were no longer autumn. The trees, rigid in windless air, were beginning to show the skeletons of their shape. Leaves no longer fell, but lay curled, sapless, on the fading grass. The sound of mournings were cautious and intermittent, as if few people were left. Down below, at the entrance, a man in a jersey was polishing his car. Edith recognised it as the car that came regularly to take Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer on their day's outing. One of the chambermaids emerged and exchanged some words, which Edith could not hear with the driver. Yawning, the woman rubbed her cheek and then stood irresolutely looking out over the lake. All the signs of impending closure, of relaxation. No one would come now. In the grey distance, Edith could barely discern the outline of the mountain. Hungry for sadness affected her that way, Edith turned back into her room and wondered why her breakfast had not appeared. She moved to the bed and picked up the telephone, mildly surprised at having to ask twice, for this had never happened before. But as she put the receiver to her ear, she could only hear a prolonged buzzing at the other end, as if there was no one to take her call. And after a minute or two, she replaced it, thinking that some of the staff must have been laid off, and that she might as well make her own way into town and have some coffee there. In any event, she was anxious to escape, for the room had become a prison, witness as it was to all her past misdemeanours, and she had no heart for pleasantry she might be called upon to exchange with the Puseys, or with Monica, or indeed Mr. Neville. While she was changing into her walking shoes, she became aware of a sudden babble of voices from the corridor. A door opened and then firmly shut, even banged, and a ringing sound of altercations, dominated by a boy's hoarse voice. Mystified, she moved out into the corridor where noises of distress could be heard coming from the direction of the Pusey suite, and where she saw Monsieur Hubert and his son-in-law conferring, apparently on a plan of action, before turning in at Mrs. Pusey's room. Both were such inscrutable expressions that Edith surmised that the previous evening's entertainment had proved too much for Mrs. Pusey, and that some sort of accident or illness had occurred, and that terrible and expert hotel arrangements were being made to move her to hospital. She retreated to her room and tried to compose herself. She felt as if grief and terror had been unleashed by her long night of introspection, and that she must now be called to account whenever and wherever damage might be done an atonement might be made. Then, composing herself with an effort, she opened the door once more and went along to the Pusey's little salon. Here she found herself the last to arrive on the scene, which already contained Monica, Alain, Monsieur Hubert, and Monsieur Hubert's son-in-law. Penetrating into the room, she saw Mrs. Pusey lying on a chaise longue, her hand to her breast, but nevertheless fully made up and wearing her pink silk kimono. And Mrs. Pusey's eyes were closed, and as Edith, shocked, wondering how she could best be of use, she saw Monsieur Hubert advance and take Mrs. Pusey's hand. Leaning over her, he murmured something that began to pat her on the wrist. The boy Alain was red-faced and near tears. He stood stiffly, staring ahead, as if facing a court martial. "Mrs. Pusey," said Edith, breaking the silence, "are you all right? What has happened?" Mrs. Pusey's eyes opened. "Edith," she said, "so good of you to come." She seemed distant, admonitory. "Go in and sit with Jennifer, would you?" With fear clutching her stomach, still innocent of breakfast, Edith went into Jennifer's room, prepared to find a scene of infraction or outrage, with Jennifer ill or possibly deranged. What she saw was indeed Jennifer, but Jennifer propped up in bed, her face moody and flushed, her mouth set in a pout, her plump shoulders emerging from the slipping décolletage of a virginal but very slightly transparent lawn nightgown. "Are you all right?" asked Edith again. "Has anything happened?" Jennifer shot her a glance. "I'm all right," she said without further explanation. "Can I do anything?" asked Edith, puzzled, for Jennifer quite clearly was all right. "Well, I could do some more coffee. This lot's gone cold." She gestured to her breakfast tray, awakening in Edith fresh pangs of hunger. "Just coffee?" she asked. "You don't want a doctor or anything?" "Good God, no. Just look after Mummy, would you? She's a bit upset." She seemed gloomy and curiously unhelpful. Sulky, Edith thought. And why so inactive? If her mother is unwell, she should be with her. What on earth is all this to do with me? She backed out of Jennifer's bedroom into the salon, where she found Monsieur Hubert remonstrating with Alain, whilst Mrs. Pusey closed her eyes again, and Monsieur Hubert's son-in-law attempted, unsuccessfully, to restore calm. Monica was leaning against the door, her eyebrows raised, her mouth wry. All looked as Edith appeared, ready to receive a message. "Jennifer would like some hot coffee," she said. Monsieur Hubert's son-in-law went out into the corridor and snapped his fingers to someone waiting outside. Monsieur Hubert, deprived of this steadying influence, took Alain by the arm and shook him. "Imbécile," he pronounced between shakes. "Imbécile." Alain, his composure floundering, breached his own code of honour and blurted, "Mais je n'ai rien fait. Je n'ai rien fait." "Imbécile," repeated Monsieur Hubert, now breathless. "Madame," cried the boy, appealing to Edith, "dites-leur, je n'ai rien fait." "Would somebody tell me," began Edith, but these cautious words were too much for Alain, and he broke away just as the tears, long held back, splurted from his eyes, and before they could catch him he was out the room, down the corridor, shouting, "Marie-Yvonne, Marie-Yvonne!" A door opened and Marie-Yvonne's frightened blonde head emerged. Blunderingly, Alain ran towards her. Her arms went round him, her head came close to his, and both disappeared down the stairs. In Mrs. Pusey's salon there was a silence, as if nobody knew what to do next. This silence was broken by the arrival of more coffee, at which time Monica, Monsieur Hubert, and his son-in-law chose to leave, assuring Mrs. Pusey that she had only to call if she needed anything. Edith made as if to join them, for clearly there was no illness, no infraction, nothing could that could not wait until later. As she moved towards the door, Mrs. Pusey made a weak gesture with her hand. "Don't go, Edith," she murmured. "I'm still in shock." But as Edith watched her sit up and pour her coffee, she seemed, perhaps by virtue of this sociable action, to recover both her energy and her presence of mind. "Take some in to Jennifer, would you, dear?" she asked, as if this was the most normal request in the world. "I've sent her back to bed. All this upset. I thought we'd spend the morning resting. Then perhaps we'll go out for lunch. Or have it sent up here. I doubt if I shall be hungry." She gave a tremulous sigh. "Mrs. Pusey, can you tell me what happened?" asked Edith, taking the fragrant and still elusive cup of coffee destined for Jennifer. "What is the matter with Jennifer? She seems perfectly right to me. And why was Monsieur Hubert shaking poor Alain?" "Poor Alain?" Mrs. Pusey bridled. "I like that. Poor Alain, indeed." "But what did he do?" pursued Edith. "Nothing," said Mrs. Pusey grimly, applying a handkerchief to the corner of her mouth. "But who knows what he might have done?" "I'm sorry," said Edith, "but I still don't know what has happened." "I slept badly," said Mrs. Pusey. "I didn't get off until dawn, and then I was awoken by a noise, a door, someone in Jennifer's room," I thought. "My heart was in my mouth. If anything happened to her..." "But nothing has happened to her," said Edith gently. "So I struggled up," Mrs. Pusey went on, taking no notice. "I rang the bell, and I forced myself to go through, although I was shaking. I may have screamed. But she was all right, thank heavens." She wiped her mouth again. "In fact, all that you heard was Alain taking in her breakfast," said Edith. "It is quite late, you know. You overslept, and you woke suddenly, and you're quite all right now." Mrs. Pusey poured herself another cup of coffee. "Oh, of course. I came back here and pulled myself together. But it's a shock, Edith, the shock." She did indeed seem agitated. "And of course, when Jennifer sees me upset, she gets upset. I've told her not to get up," she repeated. "And I've told Monsieur Hubert to put one of the maids on the floor. I'm not having that boy hanging around. I never liked him. His eyes are too small." Edith, who had been standing all this time, turned away from Mrs. Pusey's couch and walked to the window. In her mind was a picture of Jennifer sitting up in bed, her shoulders bare, her nightgown just slipping down. And then of Alain breaking into a boy's ugly tears and escaping down the corridor. And she remembered, but had she really heard it? The sound of that door opening and closing? I wonder, she thought. I wonder. She leaned her head momentarily against the cold glass of the window, leaving Mrs. Pusey to finish her coffee. She tried to quell the seeds of disapproval, of discomfort that she felt might grow rather rapidly if not subjected to some control. "Mrs. Pusey is afraid," she reminded herself. "For Mrs. Pusey's, any alteration in the status quo must inspire fear. She is old and vain, and she cannot afford to feel afraid. It is essential for her to deflect her feelings onto someone else. They will all get over it. It will all be forgotten by this evening. But from now on, I think I shall make myself less available to the Puseys. After all, we have nothing in common." She turned back in time to see Mrs. Pusey delicately spooning the remains of the melted sugar from her emptied coffee cup. "Perhaps you had better rest," said Edith, rather more firmly than before. "I should have a quiet day if I were you. I'm sure all this can be forgotten quite easily." "Of course, he'll have to go," Mrs. Pusey went on. "I shall speak to Monsieur Hubert. There'll be no difficulties there, I can assure you." When I think of all the years I've been coming here, what my husband would have done, I dare not think. She breathed heavily, her hand once more to her chest. Yes, you go, dear, if you must. I know you want to go out. Such a walker. Just send Mr. Hubert up to me, would you, when you go downstairs? Edith closed the door quietly behind her. There was no one in the corridor, no one in the stairs. Baths were running, vacuum cleaners being plied. The voices of maids could be heard raised in discussion in one of the bedrooms. Passing the desk on her way out, she could see Monsieur Hubert and his son-in-law in intimate conversation. For once, on excellent terms, their expression adult, expertly wry. Nodding slightly, she walked straight past them and out through the revolving door. The cold air, now damp with the mist that was creeping in from the lake, made her shiver. She felt quite ill-equipped and out of sorts, but also instinctively adverse to going back to the hotel for a warmer sweater. Coffee, she thought, and then a very long walk, and if possible lunch somewhere far away. I need not come back until this evening. In fact, it might be better if I kept out of everybody's way for a while. My patience with this little comedy is wearing a bit thin. Pacing through the dead leaves, her hands plunged into her pockets of her cardigan, Edith felt eddies of disturbance from the morning's incidents beginning to stiffen until they encompassed both her present circumstances and her more long-lasting predicament. Although the scene around her remained grey and chilled, although the rare faces she encountered were closed against the uncompromising weather, cautiously husbanding smiles and greetings until they might be more propitiously offered, with a safe hope of return. The small change of the day, even the impersonal sadness of the late afternoon, seemed to her more salutary than the enclosed world of the hotel, with its smell of food and scent. Its notice taken of favours granted or withdrawn, its long memories and its sharp eyes, and its contractual arrangements to behave agreeably as if nothing untowards could ever happen. It is because we are so many women, thought Edith, to whom the scene of Mrs. Pusey's salon returned most painfully. A stupid little misunderstanding like that, if it was a misunderstanding, will go on being mined for hurt feelings and will be exploited for one reason or another, whilst the rest of us will use it as a subject for conversation from here to eternity, or until one of us leaves. God knows there is little else to talk about. But it made Mrs. Pusey feel unsteady, and she's not used to that. She must talk it all away. She must distance it until her monumentary weakness is clearly seen as being someone else's fault. And in that way, the shadow of her mortality will be exorcised. She is not used to fear. She has been protected for so long that she cannot understand why she should feel vulnerable. In fact, she cannot understand why anyone should be vulnerable. That may be why she is so ruthless. She has been allowed to proceed to her present monstrous coziness through sheer ignorance of the world. Yet when her defences are breached, she reveals an altogether shrewd gasp of the tactics needed to repair them. Poor Alain, she thought, pacing along unseeingly, her head down. Yet why poor? He is probably laughing with Marie-Yvonne at this very minute. It is all over and forgotten. Yet that is not quite right either, she thought, mildly tormented. When her agitation died down sufficiently to allow her hunger to gain the upper hand once more, she turned into Hafenegger's, where she saw Monica already seated at the table and woofing down a large slice of chocolate cake. Deaf to Kiki's tiny pleas and so intent on her plate that she could barely spare the time to raise a fork briefly in Edith's direction. Edith sat down near the door, drank two cups of coffee and ate a brioche. Then, Sighing, but because she was too lonely, she moved over to Monica, whose face was now grim and wreathed in cigarette smoke. They exchanged a steady look, nodding slightly. "Well," said Edith, with an attempt at cheerfulness, "any plans for today?" "Do me a favour, Edith," replied the other. "I am not feeling particularly bright this morning, and I do not have any plans. I never have any plans. I should have thought that was fairly obvious by now. I thought you were supposed to be a writer. Aren't you supposed to be good at observing human nature or something? I only ask because you sometimes strike me as being a bit thick." She stabbed a cigarette end in an ashtray and left it there to smoulder. "I'm sorry," said Edith, removing the ashtray. "I don't feel particularly bright myself. And I didn't say I was any good at observing human nature. Why should I be? It seems to me that what I see is so very different from what I think that I don't trust my judgment anymore. I'm just disappointed, as you are. I can assure you, perhaps more," she added sadly. They brooded in the smoky atmosphere. The windows were once more steamed up, the coat rack laden with heavier garments of the late season. To solitary sounds of muted conversation, or the spoons tapped against cups of glasses to summon the waitress, brought in their wake the realization that for some people this was home. That for some people, Haffenegger's were simply a part of their daily round, their domestic routine, and that these people would go back, not to hotels, but to real houses, complete with books and television sets and kitchens, where they could sit peacefully, or read, or cook, or where they could open the back door and throw crumbs out to the birds, and where their children and grandchildren could visit them at weekends. With aching throat, Edith thought of her little house, shut up and desolate, and to which no one came. "I must go home," she thought. And then, "No, not yet, not whilst this sadness is on me. I will wait until I am more buoyant. I will get through somehow." "Monica," she said suddenly, "are you fond of your mother?" "Yes, of course," said the other, surprised. "Though she's as mad as a hatter. Small doses are quite sufficient. But yes, of course, I adore her. Why?" "I just occasionally get the feeling that I must be an unnatural daughter. My mother is dead, and yet I find that I hardly ever think of her. And when I do, it is with a wistfulness that I never felt for her in real life. Pain. And I think that this is probably how she thought of me. But I only miss her in the sense that I wish she could have lived long enough to see that I am like her in the only way she valued. We both preferred men to women." "Well, who doesn't?" said Monica, her brows arching to their fullest extent. "It occurs to me, possibly that silly instance this morning may have brought it home to me, that some women close ranks because they hate men and fear them. Oh, I know what this is obvious. What I'm really trying to say is that I dread such women's attempt to recruit me, to make me their accomplice. I'm not talking about feminists. I can understand their position, although I'm not all that sympathetic to it. I'm talking about ultra-feminine. I'm talking about the complacent consumers of men with their complicated but unwritten rules of what is due to them. Treats, indulgences, privileges, the right to make illogical fusses, the cult of themselves. Such women strike me as dishonourable and terrifying. I think perhaps that men are an easy target. I think perhaps the feminists should take a fresh look at the situation." She stopped. What she was trying to say, although deeply felt, did not make much sense. "It is I who am at fault," she thought. "It is because I am so meek that people fail to notice my demands. Or it is, even more simply, that I fail to make them. So much for honour. Honour is what David would have called a busted flush. and nobody seems to notice when it has gone. "Above my head, I'm afraid," said Monica, putting an end to her meditations. "Anyway, you've got nothing to worry about, I should have thought. Our Mr. Neville has taken quite a shine to you."
"Oh, nonsense," protested Edith, "just because we went for a walk."
"Well, he hasn't gone for a walk with anyone else, has he?"
"No, I reckon that if you played your cards right, you could have him. And he's worth quite a bit, I gather. Trade, of course."
This statement was accompanied by a particularly disdainful exhalation of smoke. It was not clear how Monica had gathered that Mr. Neville was worth quite a bit. What was clear was that Edith had not.
"Monica," said Edith warily, "that is not what I meant at all. I am not after Mr. Neville or his money. I earn my own money. Money is what you earn when you grow up. I loathe the idea of women prospecting in this way."
"No, I can't see anything wrong with it," retorted Monica, but without much heat. "Men do it too," she added after a pause. They both drooped, their spirits low, dimly aware that any remark would fail to elicit the expected response. They sat moodily, contemplating their exile. After a few moments, Monica signalled to the waitress and ordered cakes for both of them. "Why not?" thought Edith. "At least we needn't go back for lunch, and I'm not hungry anyway." They ate in silence, feeling exposed and guilty, graceless, as women eating alone without enjoyment do feel. The sweetness burst into Edith's mouth. Cloying quickly, sated, she passed a plate over to Monica, who fed the remaining crumbs to Kiki.
"I wonder that dog isn't monstrously fat," remarked Edith, "with the amount you give him to eat."
"He's six up most of it," said Monica thoughtfully, in a voice of one who is on the brink of discovering the connection between effect and cause. Through a dense fringe of hair, Kiki stared up at her with infinite trust. "And who am I to come between them?" thought Edith.
"Anyway, he's not bad-looking," said Monica, lighting one of her immense cigarettes.
"Neville, I mean. And you're not bad-looking, Edith, when you put your mind to it. Your clothes are terrible, if you don't mind me saying. Or even if you do, still, that's your affair.
No, Mr. Neville could be thought to be a catch."
"I hadn't noticed," said Edith truthfully. Monica gave her a narrow glance.
"My dear girl, that man had a price on his head the minute he walked into that hotel."
"Monica," said Edith, startled, "do you mean you have fallen in love with Mr. Neville?"
"Who said anything about love?" replied Monica, after a pause.
"Then what?"
"Oh, never mind, Edith. No, I'll pay for this. No, really, do let me. I'm going to anyway."
Edith, rubbing a patch of the steamy window clear, saw the grey mist advancing and felt herself begin to dissolve into it. This is when character tells, she thought. But her character, by which she had never set much store, seemed to have undergone a debilitating process recently. Perhaps since the thoughts of her last night, and she knew that only remedy was work. "I have done it before," she admonished herself, "and I can do it again. Besides, I am getting behind with Beneath the Visiting Moon. I promised Harold I'd let him have it by Christmas. I haven't written anything for 3 days. No wonder I feel depressed. I need to get down to some work."
"I think I'll go back," she said to Monica. "I've got some letters to write. What will you do?"
"On a day like this, the only thing to do is to go to the hairdressers and have the works. The whole caboodle. Walk round that way with me. You're not in a hurry, are you?" No, she was not in a hurry, and when the tall woman linked arms with her, she found herself touched and worn by the contact, and with the little dog bustling ahead through the leaves, they wandered slowly and silently along under the damp trees, aware of the impatient but genuine goodwill towards each other, just enough to sustain them
against the onslaught of more painful memories that came to them unbidden and uncensored. Women share their sadness, thought Edith. Their joy they like to show off to one another. Victory, triumph over the odds, call for an audience. And that air of bustle and exigence, sometimes affected by their sexually loquacious, that is, for the benefit of other women. No solidarity then. In the dead hour between 2 and 3, when sensible people put their feet up or take a nap, Edith walked with Monica under the lifeless trees by the lakeshore. The day seemed interminable, yet neither was in a hurry to have done with it. It seemed to both of them, in their separate ways, that only the possession of this day held worth days at bay, that for each of them the seriousness of their respective predicament had so far been material for satire or for ridicule or even for amusement, but that the characters who had furnished that satire or that amusement were now taking on a disturbing life of their own, were revealing capacities for command or caprice that threatened, although in a very obscure, oblique way, their own marginal existence. We both came here to get other people out of trouble, thought Edith. No one considered our hopes and our wishes, yet hopes and wishes are what should be proclaimed, most strenuously proclaimed, if anyone is to be jolted into the necessity of taking notes of them, let alone the obligation to fulfil them. Yet how curious it is that some women have to indulge and placate all the time. It seems that I shall never learn the rules of correct behaviour, she thought, those rules that girls are supposed to learn at their mother's knees. All I learnt from father. Think again, Edith. You have made a false equation. This is where character tells. Sad precepts of a lost faith. With a sigh, they turned round and began to walk back in the way they had come, in the direction of the town and of the hairdresser. The streets were dull and empty, most people having prudently withdrawn from this unpromising scene. They rounded the corner and wandered past the bookshop. Edith half-heartedly hung back to look in the window, where Le Soleil de Minuit, in paper cover, made a modest appearance. It was my best, she thought, but the prospect of doing it all over again for the rest of my life strikes a chill into my heart.
Edith,
hissed Monica,
don't hurry.
Mildly surprised, Edith looked up and saw in the distance Mrs. Pusey and Jennifer, arm in arm, emerging from a shop that sold gloves and handkerchiefs. An assistant, holding 3 of the shop's smartly decorated bags that were almost as handsome as their content, followed them after a moment or two and was directed to the car, which Edith and Monica could now perceive cruising slowly towards them from the opposite direction. The driver stopped, emerged from behind the wheel, crossed the street, conferred with the Puseys, took the parcels and got back into the car. Mrs. Pusey, apparently restored to health and equilibrium by her purchases, could be seen smiling, nodding her head vigorously, although Monica and Edith were too far away to hear what was being said. Instinctively, they backed into the bookseller's doorway in the hope of not being noticed. But after a minute or two, it was clear that the attention of the Puseys was held in one of those intense and enthusiastic colloquies from which all outsiders were definitely disbarred. This realisation, coming to them both simultaneously, caused them to exchange a look in which relief and something like resignation were exactly mingled. The thing is, said Monica, that we will either have to catch up with them or go past them or trail behind them in order to get back. You are going to the hairdresser, Edith reminded her.
Well, that's on the way, isn't it?
You have to come that far with me if you wanted to get back to the hotel.
I don't want to get back all that much, said Edith, to whom the hotel or what it represented had become uncomfortable.
In that case, decided Monica, we might as well go back and have another coffee. They retraced their steps through the little stony grey street. By this time, their earlier intimacy had fragmented into a sort of disaffection. Each was inwardly sighing at the wasted day. I should have stayed in, thought Edith. I should have spent the day writing. At least when I am writing, I am gainfully employed. This strolling about is pointless, functionless. Yet it is only a day, and I have no real duties, and I am not letting anyone down. In a way, it is quite pleasant. Really, she thought, heavy-hearted, as they made their way once more into Hafenegger. Its interior now rich with the smell of sugar and coffee, and busy with the conversations of the immaculated, stolid, well-behaved ladies who made up the regular afternoon clientele. "Makes you quite homesick, doesn't it?" said Monica, who seemed quite reduced by the fact that the attention of the waitresses was now monopolised by those stern and hearty women who seemed to have displaced her. Her face registered the wistfulness she felt at being displaced, and she busied herself with installing Kiki on a spare chair, just in case anyone should come to claim it. They sat islanded in their foreignness, irrelevant now that the holiday season had ended, anachronistic, outstaying their welcome, no longer necessary to anyone's plan. Priorities had shifted. The little town was settling down for its long, uninterrupted hibernation. No one came here in winter. The weather was too bleak, the snow too distant, the amenities too sparse to tempt visitors. And they felt that the backs of the residents had been turned on them with a sigh of relief, reminding them of their transitory nature, their fundamental unreality. And when Monica at last succeeded in ordering coffee, they sat glumly for another 10 minutes before the busy waitress remembered their order. Homesick, said Edith finally. Yes. But she thought of her little house as if it had existed in another life, another dimension. She thought of it as something to which she might never return. The seasons had changed since she last saw it. She was no longer the person who could sit up in bed in the early morning and let the sun warm her shoulders and the light make her impatient for the day to begin. That sun, that light had faded, and she had faded with them. Now she was as grey as the season itself. She bent her head over her coffee, trying to believe that it was the steam rising from the cup that was making her eyes prick. This cannot go on, she thought. Oh, Christ, moaned Monica. That does it. That's all we need. Edith raised her head and, following the direction of Monica's eyes, looked towards the doorway where Mrs. Pusey, laughing, her arm through that of Mr. Neville, was waiting for Jennifer to negotiate rights in a favourable table. The elderly man who had been sitting at the one she had chosen and who had been about to light a cigarette, changed his mind, gathered his briefcase and shopping bag from the empty seat beside him, and retired to the cash desk to pay his bill, while at the same time attempting to put on his hat and coat. As he left, he raised his hat to Jennifer, who beamed. She had, in that instant, Edith noticed, exactly the same expression as her mother. Monica and Edith sat haunched, furtive, waiting for the inevitable summons. This, however, was not forthcoming. Instead, after a few minutes, they found themselves watching the Puseys and Mr. Neville. Much sparkling laughter was in evidence, at least from Mrs. Pusey. An anecdote was being recounted by Jennifer, and Mr. Neville, his head inclined indulgently in her direction, was paying grave attention. He was not saying anything, Edith noted. It was Mrs. Pusey who was supplying the recitative. Well, said Monica, I suppose we could make a move now. She seemed thoughtful. Edith sighed and called for the bill. They waited in silence for it to be delivered, then cautiously stood up and turned towards the door. "Why," said Mrs. Pusey in surprise as they edged past her table. "There are the girls." They stood awkwardly, smiling at Jennifer and Mr. Neville, smiling back. "And what have you two been doing with yourselves all day?" said Mrs. Pusey. "Having a rest," said Edith, rather uncertainly. "Are you feeling better, Mrs. Pusey?" She noticed that Mrs. Pusey's appearance, so refulgent from a distant, could be seen at close quarters to be subject to a certain degree of disintegration. The cheekbones were rosier, the eyelids bluer, and the mouth slightly more tremulous, more smudged than usual. And yet the will was there, the indomitable will, the refusal to give up, give in, give way, stand down, stay behind. "Admirable, Mrs. Pusey," thought Edith, protected by the brilliance of her own réclame. "She will outlive us all." But she repeated, "Are you feeling better?" Mrs. Pusey cast her eyes down, then cast them up again. "Yes, dear, thank you, thank you. To these two dear people, I'm almost myself again. Though when I think..." "Must go," said Monica. "Hair appointment. Coming, Edith?" Edith mimed haste, regret, farewell, into the upturned faces of the Puseys and Mr. Neville, and followed Monica out into the street. She scarcely remembers getting back to the hotel, although the shivering once more at this mist stole in from the lake. Back in her room, she ran a hot bath until the bathroom was dense with steam. She brushed her hair furiously and left it hanging loose on her shoulders. She studied her crimson face in the glass, then walked to the wardrobe and took out a new blue silk dress that Monica had made her buy and which she had never worn. She disappeared into the bathroom with a bottle of scent and poured the entire content into the water. Heat and rebellion and extravagance served her appearance well. An altogether different creature sat down at her writing table and uncapped her pen. "Dearest David," she wrote, but caution warned her not to start her letter before dinner, because once started, she could not be sure when she would stop. She paced up and down in her room, unwilling to exchange her silent for the pleasantries of the evening. Eventually, with a sigh, she took up her bag and keys and went downstairs. In the salon, Mrs. Pusey, in her black chiffon, was, as usual, accompanied by Jennifer, who looked pink and rested. The pianist, arranging his music, looking up inquiringly at Mrs. Pusey, who, raising a deprecating hand, and shook her head, as if to indicate that her attention was not available that evening. Discouraged, he began his usual selection, but without enthusiasm. Madame de Bonneuil came rocking in, paused, and went over to Mrs. Pusey. "Alors?" she inquired in her hoarse, loud, deaf voice. "Ça va mieux la santé?" Mrs. Pusey managed a tired smile and waved a spotless handkerchief, but did not reply. Disconcerted, but only for a moment, because she was used to being ignored. Madame de Bonneuil turned away with a shrug. "Toujours pomponné," she observed to herself, as she thought, but in fact, to the assembled company. Mr. Neville, elegant, ankles crossed, remained in a far corner, obscured behind his newspaper. Edith, her head held high, advanced in his direction. "Why, Edith," cried Mrs. Pusey, with her usual vivacity, "what on earth have you done to your hair? Come and join us, dear. Let me have a proper look at you." Edith crept back to her accustomed seat, whilst Mrs. Pusey, a finger to her chin, looked doubtful. "Well, it's unusual, of course," she pronounced finally, "but I think I like it better the other way. Jennifer, what do you think, darling?" Jennifer looked up from her nails, gave a brief, vague smile. "Quite nice," she said. "Not bad at all." "Oh, but I think I liked it better the other way," said Mrs. Pusey, and with her head on one side,
continued to assess the problem until it was time to go in for dinner.